Let's go. We started. Okay. We started to explore last week the called the moral question of Sefer Yehoshua. The moral question of Sefer Yehoshua revolves around two concepts. One is the question of conquest, the right of conquest, the issue of is there a moral challenge or a moral question related to Israel's right to go in and conquer the land of Canaan, just possess the local Canaanite indigenous population and take over the land. That's question number one. Question number two, we touched upon, although we're not going to get to today, question number two is a function not of what, but of how. Assuming that, right or wrong, they are going into the land of Israel to take possession of the land, then the question of how they do so becomes a relevant factor as well. The Torah's command, the Torah's instruction related to the conquest of Canaan sounds almost Amalek in style. Lo techaya kol neshama, you can't leave anybody alive, women and children, cattle, everything has to be destroyed. So there's and there's a parallel to Amalek. It's a very powerful parallel to Amalek. Is that a fair parallel? You could ask the same question of Amalek on a certain level. The moral question we often dance around, but at some point we have to tackle, and there's really no better place to do so than Sefer Yehoshua. So we are stuck with that challenge, and that's what we're going to the best of our ability, try to address. So what we looked at last week was a focus on the opening paragraph of Sefer Yehoshua, was a focus on the word Chazak V'Amatz. And I made the suggestion that the Torah's, the Navi's emphasis on the phrase Chazak V'Amatz three times, twice in the context of conquest of the land, once in the context of Shmirat HaMitzvot, and in that latter it says Chazak V'Amatz Ma'od. The suggestion that I had made was that the phrase Chazak V'Amatz Ma'od is not just a general statement of emphasis about the mitzvot of the Torah. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're welcome to join us. Yes. The phrase Chazak V'Amatz Ma'od with regards to the Torah, the Shmirat Mitzvot, I'd suggested that it's really a reference to a specific component of Shmirat Mitzvot, namely that central motif of Sefer Dvarim, which is where the phrase comes from, a motif that focuses on the conquest of Canaan in this kind of methodology, in this kind of harsh, almost merciless kind of conquest. And that is counterintuitive. It's counterintuitive to the nature of the Jewish people. It's counter to the nature of Yehoshua. And therefore needs the Torah, the Navi, to go out of its way to say to Yehoshua, Chazak V'Amatz Ma'od, you have no choice. And you have to be strong and you have to stay the course because that's what the Torah demands. And even if it's counterintuitive, and even if you're not comfortable with it, and even if there's an element of questioning, but the result, the alternative is worse, and you have no choice. That doesn't answer the question, it just frames the question in a context in which not only are we raising the question, but to an extent you can hear echoes of the question in the mind of Yehoshua, and perhaps even in the mind of the people. So it doesn't answer the question, but it does give us some element of comfort in the sense that we're not the first to question or to challenge this methodology. So how I want to proceed is the following. I've divided the topic up into three subtopics. Subtopic one, which we'll deal with today, is the question of how do I put this? The uniqueness of the land of Israel and the theology behind the question of who is the right to be in the land of Israel. Not the politics of it, but the theology of it. The theology of it. The second subset that I want to deal with is, call it the political context of conquest. Did we conquer a territory that belonged to a foreign nation? For that we are going to have to go back to Sefer Bereshit and address the question of the early generations. Who was the indigenous population in Canaan, and did we in fact take the land from a local indigenous population, or was there some other nuance here that we've missed? That's question number two, or topic number two. Topic number three will speak to the last issue I raised before, which is the methodology. Were we in fact instructed to go and take the land and destroy every man, woman, and child, combatant and non-combatant alike? Ultimately, that's the harshest part of the moral question, and that's the question that we will address. So those are the three subsets, there are many pieces of it that will come later. In other words, we're going to talk about one component of it, but we have to bear in mind that the moral questions about methodology and about Lotachei HaKol Neshama, etc., are still there. We haven't answered them. So what we say today is not necessarily going to answer that part of it. It's a complete unit. And hopefully by the end, we will have something to work with that will make it a little easier for us to understand Sefer Yehoshua. Just before I begin, I want to tell you the context of why this question is so significant. A number of years ago, going back quite some time, so I would guess about somewhere between 10 and 15 years ago, this question became a major hoo-ha in Israel. I don't know if you recall, but there was a debate in the Knesset over this question. What was the debate about? The debate in the Knesset, not that the Knesset should bother with these things, but nonetheless, the debate in the Knesset was whether to excise Sefer Yehoshua from the canon of the Bible. Fascinating discussion. Now we're going to sit in the Knesset and debate whether or not the Book of Joshua should be included in the canon of Tanakh, or whether it's time for political correctness to simply remove it, because after all, it's not politically correct to say that we conquered the land of Israel from another power. It doesn't speak well to the modern political ethos, and that was the debate. Thank God, the conclusion of the debate was inconclusive, and they had no authority to do so anyway. But what it did spark was a fascinating day of learning at Yeshivat Har Etzion, a Yom Iyun, on the question of the morality of conquest, Musar HaKibush, and they actually published a booklet with a series of articles which were essentially the transcript of many of the lecturers who spoke that day, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, Rabbi Yaakov Maidan, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Rabbi Amital, all of the big guns in Yeshivat Har Etzion, all the heavies, with clearly different perspectives, etc., but it was a fascinating day of learning on this exact question. Musar Kibush, the morality of conquest of the land of Israel. I have a copy of it. It makes it a fascinating read. Again, from a practical point of view, Yehoshua is the starting point of Tanakh. We are certainly not going to debate whether or not Yehoshua belongs in Tanakh or doesn't belong in Tanakh. That's not in the realm of our discussion. But to get a sense of how profound this question is, that it should occupy the time of the leadership, the echelons of leadership in the state of Israel, only speaks to how profound the question is beyond the realm of the four walls of this room. So having said that, let's begin. Where does our journey start? The journey starts in the first Rashi in the Chumash. Everybody have a copy of last week's source page? Okay, these are copies. Pass them around. Source number 2 on the bottom, it's the first Rashi in Chumash. A Rashi we are most likely familiar with, if not from the text, then certainly the concept. But every time you learn something that you know already, you usually learn some new nuance to it. For that, our sages said, "Ein bet midrash b'li chidush." There is no study without some new insight. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak taught the following. The Torah really should only have started from Hachodesh Hazelachem. Hachodesh Hazelachem, Shehi Mitzvah Rishonah Shenitztavu by Yisrael, is the first commandment given to the Jewish people as a people. Source 2 on the bottom. First commandment given to the Jewish people as a nation. First commandment given to Israel as individuals goes back to Sefer Breshit. Avraham, Brit Milah, Gid HaNosheh, to Yaakov perhaps. But the first mitzvah formulated to the Jewish people and binding on generations to come is HaChodesh HaZelechem, Korban Pesach, and the Hebrew calendar. So if that's the case, asks Rashi, Ma Tam Patach B'Breshit, why did the Torah bother starting with Breshit? Understand the question. Torah means law. The word Torah means law. Hora'ah. Ataderech asher yorucha. The path that they will instruct you. The word Torah comes from the root hora'ah, which means to instruct. It's an instruction manual. It's a book of laws. If it's a book of laws, why does it need story of creation? Now, there's two ways to understand this Rashi. Some understand this Rashi specifically addressing the question of creation. Why do I need the story of creation in the Chumash? There are others who understand the question of Rashi, so why do I need everything from Breshit until Yetziat Mitzrayim? The story component of Torah is irrelevant. What Torah is mechayev, Torah obligates, is the hora'ah, or the instructions to start from Achodesh Zalachem and give us the list of mitzvot. Why do I need the whole sequence of events from Breshit until Yetziat Mitzrayim, until the Korban Pesach? So what's Rashi's answer? Mishum, the rationale is a pasuk in Tehillim. Koach ma'asavi gid la'amo latet lahem nachalat goyim. The strength of his deeds he hasn't told, revealed to his people, to give them the inheritance of nations. What does that mean? That's the pasuk itself before the application. Koach ma'asav higid la'amo latet lahem nachalat goyim. The strength of his deeds he has revealed to his people to give them an inheritance of nations. What does that mean?
Legitimacy.
So one way of understanding it is that it's a function of legitimacy. God wants us to understand the legitimate claim to the land of Israel. Koach ma'asav, the strength of his deeds he has revealed to us in the sense of why he's given us the land of Israel? Alternatively? Second possibility I actually think is more accurate to the pshat of the pasuk, even the Rashi will darshan it as you're suggesting. But the second possibility is actually, I think, more reflective of the pshat of the pasuk, namely, God's power was revealed to his people not in the legitimacy of the claim to the land of Israel, but the power was revealed through the act of giving them the land of Israel. In other words, is it a pasuk that's talking about the miracle of the conquest, the providence that God assisted us in conquering the land of Israel, and that was a revelation of God's power to us, that we were successful in conquering the land? koach ma'asav v'gidla amo, through the process of taking the land of Israel, or is it some kind of revelation for information, for moral purposes, so that we understand why we were entitled to take the land of Israel? Rashi understands it in the latter. In the context of the pasuk, I think the pshat lies with the former interpretation, but certainly Rashi understood it in the context of legitimacy. She'im yomru umot ha'olam li'Yisrael listimatem, if the nations of the world will say to Israel, you are listim. Listim means thieves, robbers. She'kvashtem arutzot shiva goyim, for you have conquered land that belonged to seven nations. You have stolen this land, it's not yours. Nations of the world don't make such claims. But in case they do, just hypothetically, then Hemomulahem, we have an answer. We have an answer. What's the answer? The answer is Kol Aretz Shalakadosh Baruch Hu. God created the whole world. The whole world belongs to God. He bra'a unetana la'asher yashar be'inav. God created it, and he gave it to whoever was good in his eyes. La'asher yashar be'inav. Be'irutzono natna lehem. In God's will, he gave it to them. V'irutzono natla mehem. Natna lanu. And in God's will, he took it away from them, and he gave it to us. Simple answer. God created the whole world. Sefer Breshit, the acknowledgement that God created the world, which is Breshit Perek Aleph, legitimates the claim that God could give the land to whoever he wants, because he owns the whole land, created the land, gave it to the nations of the world, took it away from the nations, and gave it back to us. And therefore, our claim is very simple. If you don't like it, go read Breshit Perek Aleph. This is God's world. He can give the land to whoever he pleases. Now you understand that if I took this Rashi to the United Nations, they wouldn't necessarily give me a lot of time, although, historically, you should know that the famous debate over the after the Six-Day War, when Abba Ibn stood in the United Nations and was challenged over the legitimate claim to the land of Israel, he pulled out his Tanakh, and he slammed it on the podium, and he said, here's our claim. So, in some way, this Rashi does make some impact. But nonetheless, two things I want to notice about this Rashi. Number one, Rashi's introduction, which is Koach Ma'asav Higid La'amo. To whom is this Rashi addressed? Is Rashi intending us to take this claim to the United Nations? Is Rashi's understanding of this, that in fact, here's the claim we can say to the nations of the world, if they challenge us, we can stand up and say, hey, guys, God created the world? No. Correct. And the emphasis is, Koach Ma'asav Higid Le'amo. This is a dialogue between God and his people. We need to understand. What we argue to the nations of the world is a different issue. But our argument on the political front to the nations of the world doesn't necessarily have to always match what we understand ourselves in terms of our own moral conscience. That's number one. Number two, the phrase, the key phrase in this Rashi is Hu bra'a unetana la'asher yashar be'einav. God created the world and he gave it to whomever is or was yashar be'einav. Good, righteous, straight in his eyes. What does the phrase mean? The phrase is not an accident. First of all, Rashi didn't invent the phrase. Rashi very carefully and very intentionally borrows that phrase and applies it here. And the source for Rashi's, not only for the midrashic basis of Rashi's text, but also for the language that he uses, is significant. So if you take a look, if you open up to Sefer Yirmiyahu, you're going to ask me what page. That's not going to help me a lot today, because everybody has a different Tanakh. My Tanakh, it's Taf Gimel. Art scroll, it's 107.2. Right. Well, we need chapter 27, so if you're already going there. Deserving in his eyes, righteous in his eyes. Yashar is ashrus, right? Yashar. Good. Yasita hayashar b'enei Hashem.
Chapter
27. Okay. Starting with verse 5, Pasuk Hey. Anochi asiti et haaretz, says God through Yirmiyahu. I made heaven and earth. That sounds like the context of Rashi's opening remark, right? This is a pasuk related to the notion of the creation of the world. Et adam et habeima asher pnei haaretz, the man and beast upon the land. B'kochi hagadol uvzroi hanetuya, with my strong hand, with my outstretched arm, I made this entire world. Unetati ala asher yashar be'enai, and I have given the world to whomever is straight in my eyes, righteous in my eyes. That is exactly the phrase that Rashi used. Right? Hubra'a unetana la'asher yashar be'enav. He created it and gave it to whoever is right or straight in his eyes. So you understand the context? This verse frames the context of this Rashi. But let me read two more verses. Ve'ata, now, says Yirmiyahu, that you understand that principle, Anochi natati et kol ha'aretzot ha'ele b'yad Nebuchadnezzar melech bavel avdi. I have given all of these lands into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Bavel, my servant. V'gam et chayat ha'sedeh natati lo la'avdo, and I've given him the animals of the field, everything. V'yavdu kol ha'goyim, all of the nations v'avdu oto will serve him. V'et b'no, v'et ben b'no, his son and his grandson. Ad bo et arzo gamhu, until his time will also come. Understand the fascination of this Rashi is that he takes the foundation of this Rashi is a verse in Yirmiyahu that says God created the whole world, he can give it to whoever he wants. The context of that verse, however, in Rashi is therefore Yirmiyahu 40 years before the Churban. In fact, this pasuk is this verse is actually less than 40 years before the Churban. 20 years before the Churban. Yirmiyahu is telling them, the Churban is coming, and Nebuchadnezzar is going to conquer the land, and all of you are going to go into exile, because by God's decree, he has taken this land, and he has given it to Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. So it's interesting that the same claim that Rashi uses to explain why we are deserving of the land of Israel, after all, God can give the land to whoever we want, the same claim is used by Yirmiyahu to explain why the land of Israel now belongs to Nebuchadnezzar. And we don't have the right to take it away from Nebuchadnezzar, or to stand up against Nebuchadnezzar. The big debate between Yirmiyahu and the king at the time was whether to rebel against the conquering power of Nebuchadnezzar, and the Navi said no. This is by divine decree, and you submit yourself to Nebuchadnezzar's rule, and Tzidkiyahu doesn't listen to him. That's a separate discussion. In other words, if there's a common thread between Rashi and the verse in Yirmiyahu, the common thread is that the heir to the land of Israel is not an absolute. It's not assumed that this land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people for now and for all eternity. The assumption is that the land of Israel will go to whoever is deserving at any given time. That's a fascinating twist. Rashi's whole introduction is why we are entitled to the land of Israel, but that entitlement is conditional. And we'll see what that condition is. But the context of the verse Rashi quotes tells me exactly that. that just as it was conditional, taken away from the land of, from the indigenous population of Canaan, the Amorites, the Canaanites, etc., and given to the Jewish people, at some point in the future it was taken away from the Jewish people and given to Nebuchadnezzar, and the cycle continues. Because the foundation of the land of Israel is that it is given to whoever is deserving at any given time. Doesn't mean whoever God desires, you get it, then that's it, go, everybody else can go jump in a lake. It means that it is given to whoever maintains the status of Yashar Be'enav. It is conditional. And when we as a people reach the point where our behavior is essentially no better than the behavior of the nations we displaced to take the land in the first place, then we lose that right to the land of Israel. And Tanakh makes it very clear that our claim to the land is conditional upon a certain moral, religious behavior that would not imitate the behavior of the nations of Canaan. If we did, then we lose, fundamentally, we lose that right to the land of Israel. No, it's not Negev Brit Ben Abtarim. We'll come back to Brit Ben Abtarim in a moment. It's not Negev Brit Ben Abtarim at all. Brit Ben Abtarim never says you'll have the land forever. If you're undeserving, the Torah is very clear as to what will happen to the Jewish people if they are undeserving. If they lose that moral, religious line of Yashar Be'enav. And the Nevi'im do this all the time. The Nevi'im compare the behavior of the Jewish people to the behavior of the nations around us. Not that they're the yardstick, but that if we have degenerated into a nation that is equal in moral and religious stature to those around us, we have essentially lost the legitimate right to the claim of the land in the first place. The whole basis of which we are able to dispossess the nations of Canaan and take their land is because we are assuming or claiming a certain moral theology that is deserving to be in this land. If we lose that behaviorally, then we lose that right. And that's a theme that runs through from the Tochacha until the last of the Nevi'im. I'll show you a couple of quick examples. Take a look, for example, in Yechezkel. We're in Yechezkel, chapter 5. Perek Hey. Komar Hashem Elokim. Zot Yerushalayim betoch hagoyim samtia. This Yerushalayim amongst nations I have placed her. Usvivotea aratot. And around her are all these lands. Vatemer et mishpatai lirisha min hagoyim. Her rebellion against my statutes has been worse than that of the nations. And their loyalty to my laws is worse than that of the nations surrounding her. It's a constant refrain in the Nevi'im that the Churban ultimately and the destruction and the exile of Israel is because we as a people degenerated to the point where we lost the right to remain in the land in the first place. Our right was because we were claiming a certain theology that belonged in this land and a certain moral code that belonged in this land. If we behave like all the nations of the world around us, then we lose that right. And that's a theme that carries through from Breishit until the end of Tanakh. Rashi alludes to it. Doesn't say it explicitly, but remember how Rashi begins. Rashi's thesis is, why does the Torah need to include creation? And his answer is, so we have a claim to the land of Israel. It's a very strange link. Creation is one chapter. So if your whole claim is that I need one chapter, namely Bereishit, Perek Aleph, to legitimate the claim to the land of Israel, then, or otherwise I should have started from a Chodesh Zalachem, then the question that one can ask on Rashi is, why didn't the Torah just include creation? And the rest of Sefer Bereishit is irrelevant. So for this, the Ramban expands our understanding of Rashi. Take a look at source number 3. Source number 3 is the Ramban on the same pasuk, Perek Aleph, pasuk Aleph of Bereishit. He quotes Rashi, Natan Rabbi Yitzchok Ta'am Lazeh, Ki Yitchila HaTorah B'Bereishit Bara Elokim V'Sipur Kol Inyan HaYitzirat B'Riyat HaAdam. Yitzchok explained why the Torah began with creation and the whole story of the creation of the human being. V'Shehim Shilo B'Masi Yadav V'Kol Sheh Tachat Raglav, and that God placed man over all that he had created. V'gan Eden, and an explanation, says the Ramban, this is not just an explanation of chapter 1, this is an explanation of the story of Gan Eden, the choicest of all places that God has created in this world. Third line, Ad shegiresh otoch et omisha, until man was expelled from Gan Eden, and he was expelled from Gan Eden, the choicest of all places, because of his sin. V'anshei dora mabul, and then we have the story of the flood, who were also expelled from the land, in a certain sense. In their sins, were expelled from the entire world. The righteous alone was saved, he and his children, referring to Noah. The next story after Noah is Bavel. And again, because of their sins, whatever the sin of the story above it was, because of their sins, they were again scattered through the land from one place to another. Each one according to their place. Says the Ramban, therefore the conclusion of all of this is, Imkein ra'uehu, Kasher Yosif ha'goy lachto, when a nation continues to sin, Shiovad makomo, he will be displaced from his land. And then some other nation will come and take his land. The concept of exile is not a Jewish concept. It's built into the fabric of creation itself. A nation is entitled to remain in its land, provided it maintains the morality that is expected of them. Kichenu mishpat ha'elokim ba'aretz me'olam. Such is the decree of God in the world from eternity. V'kol shekein, im ha-misupar b'katuv, ki Knan mekulal. Add to this the question of Knan's own behavior, which I'm not going to get into because that gets into the question of parental responsibility and punishment for the children. We'll come back to that a little bit later. V'eino ra'ui she'yirash mivchar mekomot ha'yishuv, Canaan should certainly not be worthy of the most choicest of all places, which is the land of Israel. Ava Yeshua avdei Hashem zera o'avo, that land is given to the Jewish people. Kinyan she'katuv, v'yiten lehem arzot goyim v'amalu umim yirashu. Klamar, she'girash mesham mordav, God has removed from the land those who have rebelled against him. V'hishkin bo ovdav, and placed therein his servants. Who knew and understood that their right to inherit the land is predicated upon their service of God. And if they will sin against God, if these people will sin, the result will be Taki Haaretz Otam. That same land will expel them. Kasher Ka'at Agoya Shalifnehem. Just as it expelled the nations before us. There is no absolute right, says the Ramban, for any nation to its land. built into the fabric of creation from every story of Sefer Bereshit is that there is a certain morality that must be maintained for any nation to remain in its place. Regardless of whether we're talking about the land of Israel, or we're talking about Bavel, or we're talking about society as a whole. There is a certain expectation, moral expectation, to which if a nation or a society degenerates to the point where it loses that moral minimum, God will address it. Sodom. Sodom is a classic example. God didn't even wait 4 generations for Sodom. And Hashem Sodom chataim l'Hashem ad ma'od, the evil of Sodom was well known. God destroyed Sodom. Dor HaPalaga, the marble, Cain. Cain kills Hevel. The punishment is exile, to wander the land. Built into the fabric of Sefer Bereshit is that there is an equation between being able to live in your land and the moral expectations that come with it. And exile is part of that process.
Expanding on that, in terms of what's happening today, in terms of the climate changes and all this, tsunamis, is that...
I don't like to make parallels to today, because you need a Navi for that. And I'm not a Navi. And you have to be very careful with applications into modern contexts. Without a Navi to tell us what's going on in the upper echelons, we can't answer that question.
No. You need to learn history, big, and I think in the second century, like in the big.
We're not going to get into a discussion of global warming. We're not going to get into the debate of whether there is global warming, isn't global warming. It's not my issue. The scientists will debate that one ad infinitum. I'm not going to bring that debate here. The overall question of whether or not one can address modern issues of either conquest or natural phenomenon and tie them to some kind of divine plan, you need to be a Navi to do that. And I'm not prepared to play God.
So all of this stops after we don't have any more Nevi'im.
The ability to make that kind of assertion,
right, those assertions,
the ability to make that with certainty, certainly stops after the end of Nevuah.
The end of what?
Excuse me? Political claims, you can say what you want, but in terms of really understanding God's plan for the world, we can make conjectures, we can try to hope, we can try to understand to the best that we can, but we certainly have to be careful. I'm very. There's 2 equations. The Gemara says that you can, if a person is suffering, they can argue. They have to look at their deeds and say, "I'm suffering because of sins, and I have to do tshuva, etc." That's all true. But the Gemara never says that if somebody else is suffering, you can turn to them and say, "You're suffering because of your sins, and you're suffering because of your deeds." There's a fundamental difference.
Right. That's what we're discussing.
Okay. People often miss that difference. It's very clear. Gemara says, "Hakoev b'rosho yifashvesh b'maasav." You have a headache, go do tshuva. Somebody else, your next door neighbor has a headache, you can't tell them to go do tshuva. That's called blaming the victim. It's a whole different issue.
But you can do it for him.
Do what? Tshuva?
Yeah.
Isn't that? Isn't that? But the moment you stand up and make the accusation that you're guilty of X, Y, Z, and that's why this is happening, you've crossed a line that's, in my mind, evil.
And what period of time does Nevuah stop?
Beginning of the Second Temple. The return from the Babylonian exiles, Chag HaZachariah Malachi, beginning of the Second Temple. What the Ramban essentially is referring to and alluding to at the very end is a series of psukim. For example, I'll give you a couple of choice samples, if you will. Vayikra Perek Yud Chet. The end of Perek Yud Chet. Chapter 18 of Vayikra. Vayikra Perek Yud Chet, starting with verse 26. Pasuk Chavav. Ushmartem atem. Everybody have it? Vayikra 18:26. Yudchet Chavav. Ushmartem atem et chukatai v'et mishpatai v'lo ta'asu. You must guard my laws and my statutes. V'lo ta'asu mikol ha'toevot ha'ele. And do not do all of these abominations. It's the end of the chapter dealing with sexual transgressions, abominations. Actually, go back to verse 24. I skipped two verses. Let's go back to verse 24. Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Al titamu b'chol ela. Do not defile yourselves with all of these things. Ki b'chol ela nitmu hagoyim asher ani mishaleach mipnechem. All these things were the conduct of the nations that I am displacing before you. Mishaleach mipnechem. This was the mode of behavior. This was the standard conduct of the nations of Canaan. And you are not allowed to defile yourselves in this way. Vatitma ha'aretz. The land became defiled with their behavior. Ve'efkod avona aleha. I visited its iniquity upon her. Vataki ha'aretz et yoshveha. And the land spewed out its inhabitants. And therefore you came into the land. Ushmartem atem et chukatai vet mishpatai. You must guard my laws and my statutes. V'lo ta'asu mikol ta'toevot ha'ela ha'ezrach ve'ageh agar betochem. Then you may not do what they did and defile the land with all of these actions. You and your citizens. And the stranger in your midst. Ve'ageh agar betochem, which is more often than not talking about the convert, but the concept called the ger toshav, the non-Jewish citizens of the land. These are the abominations that were done by the nations that were there before you. And the land was defiled. So that the land will not spit you out as it had spit out the nations that were before you. There's an equation here. And the equation is that the basis for the expulsion of the Canaanites from the land was because of their moral degeneration. Your right, therefore, to enter into the land is predicated upon your ability to behave better. If you behave in a manner that is no better than the nations that were before you, then by what right did you have to take their land? And then the land will expel you no differently than it expelled them. This is a phrase that appears in a number of places in Chumash, including Vayikra Perek Chaf, the whole Tochacha Bashat Bechukotai, the Tochacha Bashat Kitavo. It's a theme that repeats itself over and over again. The legitimacy to the land of Israel is predicated on the fact that your behavior is better than the nations who came before you. And better on a multiplicity of levels. Theological, moral, etc. But if it's not, then the natural laws with which God created the world will take place, and the takia, etc. And the land will expel you.
You don't need to separate between zchut al haaretz and yecholet megurim baaretz. Like, if somebody has a department, and he murdered somebody, so he's go to jail. He cannot live in this apartment, but the right to be in this apartment is still his. So, and I don't know, always my feeling, but maybe it was a wrong feeling because that's the way we want to feel, is that we have the right in the Eretz, but we cannot live in the Eretz if our behavior is not good enough. And I think there is a big difference in between. Because if you will say somebody will come and have, some nation will come and will have a better behavior to the God and keep, he will not there, but keep all the mitzvot, then he will deserve the Eretz better than the Am Yehudi. It doesn't look to me.
It's not a question of whether he is more deserving of the land at any given time, as much as a question of whether we become undeserving. If we become undeserving, then we get expelled. Who takes our place? That's God's cheshbon.
But that's temporarily. And
that's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. With temporary permanence is a broader issue. My issue right now is over the relationship between. It deals specifically with the Canaanites and the right to enter into the land. Whether or not there's some broader permanence versus temporary nature to this discussion, I will leave for a different discussion. You are correct that there is the promise of expulsion from the land to the Jewish people is temporary. There's a promise of return, of redemption to the land. That's true. But that's a separate part of the discussion.
I don't think so, because if you say that we can reshalech the Knani just because it's they behave not good, then if the Knani now changes behavior, the one that remains, then he has the right again to Israel?
No, that's not what the Torah is saying. In the context, you're right, there is a distinction to be made between the right to the land for the Jewish people, but right now we're dealing with the morality of conquest. The broader context of Brit Ben Haptarim and the promise of the land and why is a broader sweep of history. For now, I'm looking at this on a much narrower scope, which is the right to take a nation from its land and remove it from its land. That's the issue that I want to address for a moment. If I go back to Brit Ben Haptarim, and I go back to the very first time that God says to Abraham, your children will, not actually the first time, but the first time it's articulated as a covenant, that your children will take this land, there's a key phrase there that we need to understand, without which this question remains in our minds. If you look at Perek Tetvav, in Bereshit, Bereshit chapter 15. The Brit Ben Haptarim starts in the middle of the chapter. We saw some of this before. Start from verse 14. When you leave Egypt, remember you're going to the Brit Ben Haptarim, your children will be slaves in a foreign land, you'll go down to a foreign land, etc. Verse 14. V'gam et ha'goy asher ya'avodu dan anochi. The nation that will oppress you, I will judge. Everybody with me? What page in the article?
31
in the art school. 31. Depends whether you're looking at the English or the Hebrew. V'gam et ha'goy asher ya'avodu dan anochi. V'achrechein yetzu b'rechush gadol. And then Israel will emerge from Egypt with great wealth. When will all of this take place? When will Israel return from their exile in Egypt and return to the land of Israel? You, Abraham, will be buried in a ripe old age. You won't see any of this. When will they return? V'dor rivi'i yashuvu hena. Four generations will pass before they will return here. Ki lo shalem avon ha'emori ad hena. Because the iniquity of the Amorites will not be complete until then. This phrase is a critical phrase. Because what God is telling Abraham is the conquest of Canaan has to be moral on two sides. You have to deserve it. You have to go through a process first. Exile and slavery and servitude, etc. until you come out, and then for whatever reasons, that will bring you to the land of Israel justifiably. More importantly, for our discussion, you can't come back here until the other half of the equation, until the Canaanites have reached such a moral depravity that I can legitimately justify removing them from this land. And for that, I have to wait four generations. Now, four generations is a fascinating number. Why? Why is four generations a fascinating number? Why four generations? Just arbitrary, that's what's going to happen? It's going to be four generations, Levi, Kohat, Amram, Moshe? Or is there something else going on here? Where else have we seen the concept of iniquity for four generations? Where else have we seen the concept of iniquity for four generations? Poked avon avot abanim ve'al b'nei banim ve'al shilashim ve'al vi'be'im. God who visits the iniquity on parents, on children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to four generations. Now, understand this. We normally understand that principle as meaning that God will punish the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren for four generations for the sins of the fathers, which stands in direct contradiction to the phrase of lo yimtu avot al banim v'banim al avotam, lo yimtu al avotam, that you can't punish children for the sins of their fathers. But the truth is, in all of its applications in Tanakh, that's not what the phrase means. The phrase doesn't mean God will punish the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren for the sins of the great-grandfather. It means that God is nose avon vafesha, that God will carry the iniquity, bear the iniquity, hold off punishment for the iniquity for one generation, for two generations, for three generations, for four generations, in order to determine if there is a process of some kind of return. God will have the patience of four generations before punishing for four generations worth of rebellion. That's the principle. That's what Chazal talk about, the fact that the resolution of this contradiction is that God will visit the sons of the sins of the parents on the four generations later if ochazim ma'aseh avotem b'yadayim, if they continue the iniquity. Because the principle is not that God will punish generations 2, 3, and 4, each generation is worse. It's that God will wait, will have patience, will hold back any punishment for four generations. And for that you needed the Navi, because what often happened in Tanakh, and it happens all the time, it happened in the house of Achav. Omri, Achav, and his children and grandchildren, ultimately that iniquity for the house of Omri and the house of Achav wasn't visited until two generations later. You needed the Navi to tell them that in the days of Yeravam ben Nevat, whoever it was, that they're being punished for the sins of a great-great-great-grandfather. Because for four generations they maintained that iniquity. You needed to be able to identify historical process in set of multiple generations. That fundamentally was the job of the Navi. But that's exactly what God says to Abraham. We're going to wait four generations. You know why? Because for four generations we have to see what happens to the Canaanites. And in four generations, if the Canaanites continue in the path that they've been going, then they will reach that point of moral depravity that they will be punished for everything from now until then. And the punishment will be that they will be removed from the land, and I will give you the land in their stead. You can ask the question, what would have happened if the Canaanites would have done tshuva? Correct? I have an answer to that question. But the answer to that question will have to wait till the last part of this unit. But I do have an answer. But certainly if they don't do tshuva, the moral foundation of the conquest of Canaan is based on the immoral behavior of the nations of Canaan. To bring this to concretize this discussion, I think it's very important that we understand what are we talking about when we talk about idolatry. Essentially, the Torah's war is a war on idolatry. It's a war on the pagan cultures of Canaan, the seven nations of Canaan in particular. And I showed you the Psukim in Dvarim last week, the harshness with which the Torah describes how we have to go in and destroy not only the houses of worship and the altars and the temples, but every remnant. No museums to this culture could exist. This culture is essentially so evil, so terrible, that it had to be eradicated to the core. And I think it's vitally important that we understand what we're talking about. What is the most common indigenous deity in the land of Canaan, in the ancient land of Canaan? Remember that every nation had their own deity. That's also a concept which is clear in Tanakh. We've lost that notion, that sense of today, but every nation had a different god. It wasn't like, you know, people have today, faith and nationality are independent of each other. In the biblical arena, faith and nationality are intertwined. If you belong to a particular nation in a particular land, then you were identified through a faith in a particular deity. And we know many of them. We know, for example, that the deity of the Plishtim was called Dagon, which was a fish god of some kind. We know that the idolatry of Moab is called Kmosh. The idolatry of the god of Ammon is called Milcom. Milcom is another name for, I don't have a whiteboard marker, but I would. Milcom is another name for Mem Lamed Chaf Mem. Molech. Milcom is another name for Molech. Molech is a very common pagan idolatry of the land of Canaan. It was called child sacrifice through fire. So they took their firstborns and put them through the fire and killed them through the fire as a Molech, as an offering to their gods. The most common deity in the land of Canaan was the deity of Baal. Baal and Ashtoreth. Baal is the god of rain. And Ashtoreth is a tree. Ashtoreth is Baal's consort. There are many gods in the ancient world. Pagan gods were partners, male-female partners. Sexuality played a large role in pagan idolatry. Baal was essentially the god of rain, and Ashtoreth was his consort. And you had temples to Baal, and you had temples to Ashtoreth. The Asherah, which is the tree, essentially connected to the Avodah Zarah of Ashtoreth. Many of the temples to Baal were on high mountains, like Har HaKarmel, because... Not Baha'i, high, right? Height, right? We're height, right? We're on high ground because you're praying for rain. The god of rain is in the clouds. The higher you are, the better you are. Or in places of water, like the oasis of Jericho. Jericho was a center of Baal, because it was an oasis in a desert. Ever been to Jericho? Mm-hmm. It's this lush green oasis sitting in the middle of a brown desert because it's built on underground springs. It was a perfect place to put a temple to Baal because you had the water. Baal is the god of rain. Rain seeds the ground. Out of the ground grows trees. Baal seeds Ashtoreth, right, male and female, and that you have a very powerful sexual connotation to the adult, to the pagan idolatry. The methodology of service to the idolatry of Baal and Ashtoreth, if the deity of Molech demanded child sacrifice, and you can't really understand the story of Avraham and the Akedah without realizing the backdrop of a society predicated on the concept of Molech as a value. And child sacrifice is a fundamental component of life in that milieu. You understand the challenge of the Akedah and the revolution that the Akedah created when God said no. It was a revolution. The Akedah was actually standard fare. You could even argue that for Abraham it was, okay, God is no different from all the other gods in this world. That's what's expected. And God said, no, that's not what's expected. Baal, if Molech was child sacrifice, what was the idolatry of Baal and Ashtoreth? How did you sacrifice to the god of fertility and rain? Right? You'll pardon the expression, virgin rape. You took your virgins, your young girls, and you offered them to the gods, and the priests of Baal would have their way. And you had a very powerful sexual experience and religious experience at the same time. This was standard fare. Murder, idolatry, adultery, virgin rape, child sacrifice, this is the standard of morality of the nations of Canaan. It's not an accident that after the entire list of erva, of all of the adultery practices of Canaan, the Torah adds the prohibition of molech. And the Mefarshim struggle with the question. There's a Gemara that says, anybody who says that molech was a form of adultery or a form of sexual violation is mistaken. But the mistake is an easy one to make, because molech is listed at the end of the list of sexual crimes. Why is it there, though? What's the pshat? Why is it there? Because when you combine molech with Baal, you have the two most abominable idolatries of the ancient world. Baal was essentially erva, and molech was child sacrifice. You put them together. And the Torah's war was against both of them. It was a society that was immoral to its core. And the immorality of it was not ben adam l'makom. The immorality of pagan idolatry had nothing to do with God. The immorality of pagan idolatry was between man and man. It was the beast of the human being. And you can't understand the war that the Torah goes to destroy idolatry, to eradicate idolatry, without realizing that idolatry in its core was immoral in every sense of the term, ancient and modern. Wars today in the 20th century have been fought. International wars have been fought for less moral ground than the war that the Torah engaged in against the immorality of the nations of Canaan. We haven't gone to war for human rights. We haven't gone to war with nations in order to liberate them from regimes that were oppressive and denying civil rights to people. We were talking about cultures that by their core of their being were predicated upon virgin rape and child sacrifice. In such a world today, we wouldn't go to war to remove such a culture from the land. Of course we would. So the foundation of the conquest of Canaan has to be understood against the backdrop of Ad Dor Vi'i Ashuv Ve'ena Ki Lo Shalem Avon Ha'emori Adena. For four generations, God will wait and see what they do. And if they don't change, then this threat to the conquest of Canaan will hang over their heads, and then we will remove the nations of Canaan, and you will take their place. And then the challenge will be whether you're able to live any better than they.
And now we hope to be accountable because there is a moral conquest. It seems at that time there was no moral conquest.
Say that again?
I said now we would go to the important abominations and civil rights things because of we have a moral context, but then there was no moral context.
Why not?
For these nations.
Why not?
How about they were exposed to the Torah and then they knew this is...
First of all, you have Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach starts from Avraham. And immorality has an objective standard. It's a famous debate amongst philosophers whether there's an objective standard to morality. Is morality wrong? Is immoral behavior wrong because I think it's wrong? Or is there an objectivity to a immoral behavior? The Torah's perspective is crystal clear. There is an objective standard of morality. It comes from creation. It comes from the principle of Tzelem Elokim. And if the human being wants to destroy that, that's their choice, but they'll pay the consequences. I don't need a Torah.
So it was a conscious choice of idolatry.
It was a cultural choice. But its evil is no less. Its evil is no less.
Murder is.
Adultery is.
Right.
Child sacrifice, murder, virgin rape, absolutely. So is monotheism, when you look at it from that perspective. Right. So is monotheism. It's no question. The moral depravity that the Torah talks about is a moral code that was set in place from this moment of creation. That's where Rashi links it to creation. That's where Rashi links it to Bereishit. We're not talking about imposing the Torah's 613 mitzvot upon the nations of the world. We're talking about imposing a morality that stems from creation upon the nations of the world. A universality to a moral behavior. And in a society where child sacrifice is standard, then it becomes our responsibility to stop it because it's immoral.
Per the seven laws.
Absolutely. Murder.
Two questions. One is, if it was that horrendous, which it was, why didn't you just create an earthquake and destroy that whole
Well, planet? To some extent, that's what God did. It's dumb. Right? But there comes a point where the early generations, God had a much larger role in the development of society. Creation, Babel, right? Flood, Babel, Stone. But the truth is that the moment, it's a much broader discussion, but the moment God placed Israel on the agenda of nations, from that point of view, in a certain sense, God takes a step back. From playing the role of the policeman of society, God takes a step back and lets us, or society as a whole, take responsibility for who and what we become.
The other thing is, if the earth is alive, like Mother Earth, that area has been defiled. Okay, so how does that...
If the earth is alive, did you say?
You know what I mean. I mean, if that area is defiled, like what human beings do to it, how is that cleansed?
By removing the evil, by removing the idolatry, and it's not, there's no physical, it's not like there's something has to go to the mikveh type of thing. It's a conceptual framework. It's a conceptual framework that the land is that your behavior is causing. Right? The Navi himself, Yechezkel, describes the behavior of the Jewish people in the land of Israel like tumata nida. It has to be removed. There's a series of these equations or metaphors of the role of tumah in this context. Okay, I can say ladies.
Oh my gosh.
I have to look around and say it. I have to look around for a second. Ladies. Next week, we will adjourn here.